Hello, and welcome to Talking Brains. I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Sarkis. Today we'll be learning about malevolent OCD, also known as monster OCD. Hit that subscribe button and give us a rating, and that would be much appreciated. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Talking Brains podcast. Today I'm talking to Dr. Seth Gillihan. He is a licensed psychologist, and the way we met is that we are both contributors for Psychology Today, and I was on Seth's Think Act Be podcast. So he is a clinical assistant professor of psychology in the psychiatry department at University of Pennsylvania. He has written and lectured nationally and internationally on cognitive behavioral therapy and the role of the brain in psychiatric conditions. His books include Cognitive Therapy Made Simple, Retrain Your Brain, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy in 7 Weeks, and Overcoming OCD, A Journey to Recovery with Janet Singer. His forthcoming book, A Mindful Year, 365 Ways to Find Connection and the Sacred in Everyday Life with Dr. Arya Campbell Danish will be published in fall 2019. Dr. Gillihan also blogs for Psychology Today and hosts the weekly Think Act Be podcast, which features a wide range of conversations about living more fully. He has a clinical practice in Haverford, PA, where he provides treatment to adults with OCD, anxiety, depression, and related conditions. You can find him on the web at sethgillihan.com, and I'll spell that for everybody. It's sethgillihan.com. Well, welcome, Seth.
Thank you, Stephanie. Nice to be talking with you again.
Yeah, I really enjoyed talking with you on your podcast. And today we're going to be talking about something different than we talked about in yours. We're going to talk about malevolent OCD. And right before I started recording, we were talking about how I see people that have obsession compulsions with thinking that they hit people while they were driving. And so they'll turn around and drive and go back to where they were to make sure they didn't hit someone. And you're saying that's not specifically malevolent OCD. So if you could explain a little bit of the difference between, you know, what I see usually in my practice and then what malevolent OCD is.
Sure. So, I mean, that's they're closely related, that idea. I mean, the idea of you know, did I harm someone in OCD? It's really common among different types of obsessions a person might have. But I wanted to distinguish a specific, it's really a subtype of harm OCD. So harm OCD is the fear, you know, maybe did I accidentally contaminate someone's food when I was making them dinner? Is someone going to get hurt because I didn't warn them about something? Like, say, like, you know, be careful with the ice out there. It's slippery when you're driving, which is similar and overlaps for a lot of people with what I'm calling malevolence OCD. And I gave it that name because I wanted something that captured the fear of doing something truly evil, truly reprehensible. You know, you wouldn't say that forgetting to warn someone, you know, to be careful when driving is evil. But, you know, for malevolence OCD or MOCD, you know, a person might worry, like, what if I'm a pedophile or what if I'm a mass shooter and, you know, I'm going to do something awful? Or what if I stab someone that I love, that I, you know, I don't want to stab anyone, much less, you know, this person I love or God forbid, my pet. So I wanted to give it a name that seemed to capture, as I imagined it, the fear that a person with that subtype had, which really is being somehow a vile person.
Do you have just a ballpark estimation of how many people with OCD have the malevolent form?
You know, I don't know. I don't know that because usually it's not broken down by, you know, sort of subtypes. So it's there probably are data I don't have at my fingertips about, you know, how many people have harm-related OCD versus contamination OCD. I do know it's harm is, as I said, fairly common. And this type of harm OCD, malevolence OCD, I think is, I mean, in my experience, not at all uncommon, and I think much more common than people who have it probably realize. I think they often feel, you know, all alone, sort of singularly bad about it. But you know, I see it a lot. I think it actually is probably a fairly common type.
Would you say it's also a type of OCD that people may be more hesitant to seek help for because of the thoughts they're having?
Absolutely. Yes, because the fear for a lot of people, and sadly it's confirmed in some cases, is that if they tell someone they're having these fears, they'll be misunderstood as the person actually wants to act on them. And, in our current climate of see something, say something, they're afraid they're going to be turned in and, or their kids are going to be taken away or these awful things might happen just because their brain is lying to them.
And I'm assuming that makes the obsessions and compulsions even worse. With that anxiety happens.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, exactly. Yes, the fear of how they're going to be seen by other people and then the, getting in the way of getting treatment that could help.
And I was also going to ask, you wrote a really good article for Psychology Today called 7 Ways Therapists Can Mess Up the Best OCD Treatment. If you could talk a little bit more about exposure and response prevention, which is a very effective form of treatment for OCD. How does that play into treatment for malevolent OCD?
Yes. Great question. So there aren't a lot of treatments that work for OCD in general, and exposure and response prevention is one of the very few. It's considered the first line treatment. So, you've got fears that awful things are going to happen. Let's say here I have, for example, the fear I'm going to stab someone that I love. And so that's the obsession, that repeated thought of something awful happening that I really don't want to have happen. And then the compulsion is doing anything that I can to prevent that thing from happening. So in this case, it might mean avoiding being around knives. It might mean turning off shows that talk about knives or talk about someone being stabbed, not watching the evening news. So lots of kinds of avoidance. So the treatment for OCD that's most effective is to address both of those things, the obsessions and compulsions. And we start by addressing the compulsions. And once a person stops doing those compulsive behaviors that are meant to keep them safe, then they can start to break the cycle of OCD. Because as anyone with OCD or who knows someone with OCD knows, compulsions just lead to more compulsions, which lead to more obsessions, and a person stuck in this awful cycle that can take hours and hours out of their day and years out of their life. And so you might have someone work up to being able to do things like handle knives around people that they love, to not avoid things related to knives, maybe reading stories involving people who got stabbed, and over time gradually becoming more comfortable with the things that previously made them really afraid, and not having to do compulsions to get through their day.
And also in your PT article, and then on, you had an article or in the Journal of Obsessive Compulsive and Related Disorders about common pitfalls. And I guess I just want to emphasize for clinicians, this isn't something you just go out and start trying, that you have to really assess your client to see if this is an appropriate treatment. So what are some of the roadblocks that or challenges that clinicians need to particularly pay attention to if they're looking to start practicing exposure and response prevention?
Well, one of the main ones that we see, and this is even among people who have gone through an intensive multi-day training course with real experts in the area, the people who literally wrote the book on exposure and response prevention treatment, still we were seeing repeatedly, and I was seeing in myself, I started out, these kinds of mistakes. So things like not going far enough in a person's exposures, so stopping at a point where the person starts to really feel uncomfortable rather than encouraging them to keep pushing so they can really push through the obsessions and the fear. So in this case, a person might say, well, I'll work up to being around knives, but I'm gonna put the knife down when someone that I care about comes close to me. Or okay, I'll hold a knife when my spouse is around, but not when our baby is in the same room. And all that does is just leaves an out for OCD to say, yep, see, if you'd actually done that thing, if you'd picked up the knife when your child was there, you might have acted on what feels like an urge to be violent toward your child. So not going far enough is a big one. And, there are different kinds of exposure that a therapist can do. Some are done in real life, so things you can actually do, like picking up a knife, holding a knife. There are lots of kinds of MOCD. I'm just using a knife to keep it simple. But there also are ones called imaginal exposures, ones that a person does by thinking about things that could happen. So this could be helpful for something that's that you can't actually expose someone to. Like, you can't actually expose someone to the reality of acting on their fears, because, I mean, that would obviously not be a good exposure. Wouldn't even be legal, for that matter. So you have them think about something terrible happening, and you know, or, you know, in the case you brought up of someone who's afraid of driving, you ask them to imagine, you know, having actually, you know, causing hit and run accident that they're afraid of. And by thinking about that scenario over and over, it starts to lose the grip that it has on a person, and makes it easier to let go of the obsessive fears. So I think those are two big ones that come up. The final one I'll mention, because it happens so often, probably I would hazard to say every time someone who's not trained in treating OCD does therapy for OCD, they probably fall into the trap of giving reassurance. So telling the person, it's okay, you're not a monster, you're not going to do anything bad. And that's fine to tell someone that once as part of education, but then it can quickly become part of the obsessive compulsive cycle. You know, I feel really afraid, I had an urge, does that mean I'm going to stab someone? No, it's okay, you're not a danger to anyone. And that just feeds into that loop and keeps it going. So as part of therapy, we have to work with the person to stop giving reassurance and for them to stop asking for it.
So, for example, and I know this isn't a form of malevolent, but when somebody's driving, think they hit something, a friend of mine that treats OCD, well, the person will, he'll actually be in the car with them, and the person will turn to him and say, did I hit something? And he'll say, well, you may have not. So it adds that ambivalence, yes, to the brain. And so it sounds like the ambivalence kind of wears the OCD out in a way. I don't know if that's the correct way to say it, but.
I think that's a really nice way of saying it, Stephanie, that what OCD is really after is eliminating ambivalence and uncertainty. And if we leave that uncertainty there, then it kind of takes the fuel or robs OCD of its the fire that fuels it, because, you know, it's kind of like if a bully comes up to you and, you know, calls you nasty names and you say, eh, all right, yeah, whatever, then it sort of loses its fight.
I really like that bully analogy. That's great.
Yeah, I didn't make that up, but yeah, it's a common analogy. There's so many of these metaphors for OCD treatment.
So you're saying kind of whatever to the OCD, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Whatever. Or say like, yeah, maybe I did. Yep, I probably did. Probably just ran over someone, and I'm gonna keep on driving. Just wait for the police. I'm sure they'll be here eventually.
Right. Because if you tell someone, well, you know, if you did run over somebody, the police would show up. Then again, that's probably reinforcing it, I would think. Because that's reassuring.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's especially hard for family members not to do, because, you know, for 97.5% of the population or so, it's the right thing to do when they ask for reassurance, because you give it and they feel reassured and we move on. But before that, you know, 2-3% of people with OCD, most likely it's going to keep them stuck.
And would you recommend something to family members to say instead of reassuring? Because I could see where that would be really difficult, because you don't want to see the person you love suffering. So what would be an appropriate thing for the person to say? Or would you tell the person, you know, go ahead and do what you've been doing and then add on the therapy as the adjunct to that?
Well, yeah, I think it is. It's a really important conversation to have. I mean, you know, in the ideal case, the person with OCD stops asking, but it is good to have a kind of stopgap measure where you have a discussion with everyone in the room who's involved, and there's an agreement between person with OCD and loved ones that, you know, if I ask, here's what's going to be helpful for you to say, here's what's just going to, you know, make me more anxious or irritated, but, you know, some kind of something supportive that's not reassurance. So for some people that might be, you know, saying something like, sounds like the OCD is bothering you now. What do you need to do to get through this? Or how can I support you through this? Or what can you use from therapy that can be helpful to you now?
Okay. So maybe jog the memory and calling it OCD rather than you. It's important to kind of externalize it, it sounds like.
It is, yeah, okay. If possible. I know for family it can get frustrating, especially when the reassurance seeking just comes and comes, and family members can can at times get frustrated, but yes, to remember that it is the OCD that's compelling the behavior.
Now, I'm guessing too that using positive reinforcement, the same to the person, oh, hey, you haven't asked for reinforcement, or you haven't asked for double check on it. It sounds like that would actually increase the loop of OCD if they use positive reinforcement, or does it?
Well, yeah, it depends on the person. Okay. So, you know, for all these things, it kind of depends on what the function is for the person. So you want to check it out, kind of see if is it kind of artificially decreasing their anxiety, in which case it's probably feeding into compulsions, or does it just feel good to be complimented like that? In which case it's probably a good thing to do.
And I also had a question on medication. What's the role of medication in treatment for OCD? What are the most commonly prescribed medications? And also, is it almost a prerequisite of getting treatment or not?
Or definitely not a prerequisite. Okay. There are a lot of people who battle their OCD and are able to get tremendous amount of relief without any medication at all. For those who do take medication, most commonly prescribed are the SSRIs like Prozac and Zoloft, usually at quite high doses, typically around triple what you might give for a therapeutic dose for depression. And I don't have those numbers how often people need it, but a lot of times when a person starts therapy and it's the right therapy, but they're not able to get much traction, maybe because the compulsions are just so hard to resist because anxiety is so high. Some people find it may be helpful to start on a medication that can take some of the edge off of the intensity of the obsessions, which then makes it easier to engage in treatment. So some people do both. Some people do medication only. Some do therapy only, but a lot of people use a combination.
Okay. So better, both, in an ideal situation, both work better together than either by themselves.
No, not necessarily.
No, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean that may be the case for some people, but I wouldn't put that forward as a rule.
Okay.
We do know something about medications that don't help, and probably the most commonly prescribed ones that don't help, you can probably guess, are the benzodiazepines like Xanax and Klonopin. It seems like, oh, you're anxious, here's a sledgehammer to tamp down that right. anxiety. And but it's a pretty ineffective treatment in terms of really addressing the obsessions and compulsions.
That also leads me to another question, which is, what's the difference between having a malevolent OCD and having generalized anxiety and high anxiety to the point where your brain just kind of goes to those places where you don't want it to go? Is there a specific difference? Or, because I get asked that quite a bit, you know, what's GAD, generalized anxiety disorder, and what's OCD when you're thinking that you might hurt somebody?
Right. Well, I mean, a couple of big differences. One would be, you know, how generalized it is. I mean, sort of as the name suggests. I mean, some people with MOCD have a lot of other kinds of OCD, but some people have really, this is the only one they have, and so it'd be obvious in that case that it wasn't generalized anxiety, but in general between OCD and GAD, I mean, at the boundaries, the two can kind of blur where it's hard to tell one apart from the other, but thankfully it doesn't make much of a difference necessarily in what's going to be effective as treatment. Okay. But in generalized anxiety, you tend to see a lot of just, you know, worry and mulling things over and, you know, turning them over and over in your mind, but not the same type of deliberate attempts to do something to prevent the harm from happening. So a person might worry, you know, what if I'm not careful enough? What if I don't do something to make sure that my child is safe? And in generalized anxiety, without necessarily having a lot of compulsions that go along with it. But that said, you know, even the act of turning something over and over and over in our minds, trying to make sure things are okay, that can be a symptom of OCD. So again, you know, at the extreme, at the margins of these two, I don't think you can necessarily tell them apart that easily.
And when you're doing exposure response prevention, do you ever find that sometimes people's obsessions and compulsions trade out for other ones? Do you ever see that happen? So the brain goes, ah, okay, I'm not going to do malevolent OCD. I'm going to do dermatillomania, skin picking. Or do you see that ever where it just kind of changes forms?
We do see that. Okay. It's not certainly not unheard of. And you know, the nice thing about this treatment is that you can apply it to anything that comes up. So it's important, you know, to train the person early on that this is for all kinds of obsessions and compulsions. This is not just for what we start with, so that it doesn't become, you know, kind of a game of whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. One thing that will often show up, you know, OCD, it's so slippery and tricky and likes to stick around however it can, you know, kind of like a virus that just wants to replicate itself. And so this is a particularly kind of pernicious attempt of OCD to stick around, which is developing OCD about the treatment. So starting to focus on, am I going to get better? Is it working? Do you think I'm going to improve? And then maybe seeking reassurance about that and being compulsive about doing the OCD homework. So you really have to be, again, I think this is where the experience is helpful and really comes in when, you know, it might look at first like the person is like, wow, two thumbs up. You are going above and beyond doing, you know, everything I'm asking you to do, really fighting your OCD. And then some point you're like, wait a second, this is starting to feel strangely reminiscent of what brought you in.
Mm. And in that case, again, you keep going with the same treatment because you have the same underlying, I guess, structure of the obsessions and compulsions. It's just changed. It's just morphed into something else. Or like you said, it's tricky and it morphs into different things.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That's nicely said. Same process, different content.
Because that makes sense, because I would see as a therapist, you go, oh, hey, you're doing all your homework. That's great. But then it gets to be kind of beating yourself up if you don't complete the homework. Or if you don't complete the homework, you think something bad's going to happen to someone that you love. Or is that the kind of...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I worked with someone once who was afraid that he was going to jump off a bridge. And so, you know, the treatment, of course, was to... And then this is... probably goes without saying, someone who was not actually suicidal, who actively, you know, wanted to live. And so the treatment involved, you know, progressively working up to bigger bridges. And then once we had done the biggest one around here, he started looking around the country for bigger bridges to tackle. And then we had to have a discussion about how this was becoming, you know, an effort to get certainty that I would never jump no matter how big the bridge, versus saying like, all right, looks like it's probably not going to happen, and whatever uncertainty is left with, I'll just have to live with.
Okay. So going back to being okay with the ambivalence, being okay with that gray area, but not being completely solved.
Yes. Yes. That is really such a consistent marker of when his OCD is looking for that 100% certainty.
And I think that that's something the brain really likes with most people, is having that closure, completing that circle. And it sounds like with OCD, you never really get that full closure, but it's learning to be okay with that, not completing that circle.
Yes, that's okay. Right. And yes, getting more comfortable living with that partially open circle that basically all of us live with, but most of us don't think about. You know, you and I are both sitting in each of our own offices, and, you know, where I'm sitting, there's a non-zero chance that a train could derail and come smashing through my window. But I mean, that, you know, could happen, but unlikely enough that I don't worry about it. But when OCD grips us with its fear, then we can fall into a pattern of trying to be sure what we're afraid of won't happen.
Mm-hmm. And the Dalmatian says, yes, that could happen, because he has some OCD. He's barking in the background. He's saying, be careful. So what I run into where I live is that sometimes people have obsessions and compulsions about something from NASA coming over and hitting us, because we're about an hour, 2 hours away. So that's kind of an interesting concept that, yes, it could happen, but the chance of it happening are pretty small. So I'm wondering, what do you do when it's something that is plausible? Probably it's plausible, but not probable. How do you work with that? Because that's always been tricky for me, because I don't want to tell people, no, that's never going to happen.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, usually something along the lines of, I mean, that's really unlikely to happen, but it could. But, you know, I like your odds. So, mm-hmm. But, you know, balancing those two things. Yes, it is it is possible, but you know, chances are you'll probably be okay. But I mean, how do I know for sure? You know, like I think I looked this up a number of years back. Something like 20,000 commercial planes land safely in the U.S. every day, and you know, thankfully, you know, you hear about major crashes so rarely. And yet, if someone asks, you know, do you think is my plane going to crash? Really, the best you can say is like, probably not. Like, but I can't say for sure. I'm just some guy. Like, what do I know? But, but you know, we live our lives through that uncertainty. Because right. Really, what's the alternative?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a really good question. What is the alternative? Yeah, you wonder if this stuff's going to happen to you, and you wait around for it to happen to you, and usually doesn't. And then I noticed too, like I call what you're saying about people worrying about treatment, I call that kind of meta anxiety, having anxiety about their anxiety.
Yes.
And then people worrying about, well, I've spent all this time thinking about whether the rocket's going to hit my house, and what am I going to do with all that lost time? And then there becomes an obsession with I've lost that time.
Right. Right. Yes. And the whole thing kind of eats its tail.
Right.
You know what OCD is kind of like, and especially maybe malevolence OCD, it's like having a gaslighter in your brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Yeah.
Really, I mean, you know, one who wants to influence kind of how you see reality and manipulate you to carry out its will. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess things you and I think about have more in common than I might have realized.
Yeah, I always tell people it's kind of like your brain's being a jerk. Or the OCD is just a jerk that doesn't want to leave your brain. And it finds these ways to kind of manipulate you. Yeah, I describe a lot like that. So, and thanks for tying in gaslighting. Because, I think, I actually, when I work with people with OCD, I haven't actually connected gaslighting. I think I want to start doing that now. Because that's a great way of describing it, that your brain is just kind of pulling a fast one on you.
Thank you. Yes. So. And you know, the way you can start, I mean, the isolation can happen, really kind of starting to live out this person's idea of what you should be doing.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to bring up too the power of people coming together and talking about this, because you have a Facebook group, and I was really impressed to see that the Facebook group is a little over a month old, and you already have over 100 members.
I was really that just happened recently, crossing that 100 person mark, and I let the group know, you know, that we're growing, which is great to see. And but you know, more than that, I'm just so pleased to see how open and supportive people have been with each other, because there was such an outpouring when I wrote a post about malevolence OCD a couple of years ago, and just person after person write to me and say, it's such a relief. I had no idea. You know, I felt so alone. I thought I was a terrible person. And now I feel like I can have a life again. And mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, maybe we can, you know, keep this going, bring people together and continue to spread the word. So I'm glad that the group's doing well. And I appreciate, you know, being able to talk with you about it to further spread the word.
And I think it's really nice too. It's not just people that have MOCD. It's also family members, therapists, people that just want to know more about it. I think that's wonderful. It's people from all different kind of areas coming together. And it is a closed group, which is nice, because that means it's only the people. For people who aren't familiar with Facebook groups, a closed group means that it's you have to be approved to get in the group. So you don't see everybody's information up front, which is nice too.
That's right. Yeah, I knew that would be an important part, since it's, you know, such a sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm. It's called Malevolence OCD and then Fear of Hurting Others on Facebook. And it sounds like it's a forum where people can share their experiences and people can chime in and.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I share things there on a regular basis. I'll be sharing, you know, link to this podcast and podcast I'm going to do with an expert on harm OCD in the coming months. So yeah, a lot of stuff going on there.
I also want to point out too, if people want to know a great way, or clinicians are listening, want to find out a great way to tie in social media to your practice, you're really a master at it.
I appreciate that.
It's really impressive. So when I did your podcast, I know it was, you put it on your Psychology Today page and did a transcript, and then it was on your website. And it's a really masterful way of tying everything together and reaching as many people as possible, which is kind of why we're here. We want people to be have this alleviation from this suffering. So
I really appreciate that, Stephanie. You know, someone mentioned to me recently that they enjoy seeing the dissemination work I'm mm-hmm. doing, which at first I was like, I guess this is dissemination. You know, I'm so used to thinking of that in a more academic or kind of institutional context. Mm-hmm. But yes, here we are kind of taking these things directly to people.
Right. Absolutely. And I also want to ask you, too, with malevolence OCD, what are some of the common comorbid disorders you see with it? Are there some that happen more than others?
Well, certainly, generalized anxiety, like we talked about, is not uncommon. A person may be experiencing both. But, you know, a lot of people have depression. And, I mean, it seems that most of the depression or more of the depression comes after the OCD rather than before, because, you know, a person may be having a horrible view of themselves based on, you know, this internal gaslighter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is often withdrawing from things that are important to them, you know, like the woman who has never seen her nieces and nephews because she's afraid that she might do something awful to them. And that mm-hmm. kind of disconnection, it really can be heartbreaking, and especially if we think it's because there's something terrible about us. So those are some of the most common ones. Some people use substances. You know, the person may have an alcohol use disorder or a problem with cannabis because they're using it to numb the feelings and the fear.
Do you find, though, with substance abuse that when the substances wear off, there's almost a rebound effect of the malevolent OCD?
Well, absolutely. I mean, for any kind of OCD, yes. Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, it's one of the cruel things about using those kinds of means to cope, is they do tend to have that bounce back effect.
And so I'm assuming that when you see some of the substance abuse and OCD, is the general rule, like with other disorders, like I primarily work with ADHD, that you treat the substance abuse first and then you treat the issue, or you treat them both at the same time? What's the general?
You know, in my training when I was working at Penn as a faculty member, we had multiple trials where we were treating two conditions at the same time, like alcohol use and post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, because a lot of times people find themselves in this kind of no man's land where they can't get help for their OCD because people are telling them to get their substance problem treated, but then they're having a hard time quitting or staying quit because they're dealing with so much anxiety or obsessions. So, you know, if possible, if someone's using alcohol to cope, but is basically functioning, then we can often, you know, address the two and, you know, at the same time, and decreasing use of substances during treatment can be a part of the exposure and response prevention. So getting rid of, right, you thinking of it as something that's used to manage anxiety. So, of course, you know, a person would need to be reasonably, you know, familiar and proficient treating mm-hmm. problems with substances to do this. But you know, I think that the two can be managed together.
And when you brought up PTSD, it made me think, so how much of OCD do you think develops as possibly the root of it is a trauma, and then OCD either manifests itself, it was latent and it shows up because of a trauma, or there maybe not even be a family history and it shows up? Do you ever see that where PTSD almost sparks the OCD to start?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, we definitely see that. And you know, there are so many different types of post-traumatic reactions. For some people, it is OCD is their post-traumatic reaction. It's not at all the rule, I would say. You know, for a lot of people, there's no identifiable thing that started it. We know that stress in general raises the odds of having OCD, mm-hmm. but yes, for some people, they certainly do trace it back. You know, maybe some people are dealing with both PTSD and OCD, which seem to have come from, you know, the same period or same incident.
And for people that just have OCD, how important is getting family history and diagnosis and treatment?
Well, I mean, it can be important. Okay. It can, especially, you know, if there may be a question about is this generalized anxiety versus OCD, and if you see there's a lot of OCD in the family, maybe that's helpful. But, you know, obviously it's not the final word on the person's diagnosis. But I would say, you know, much more important than having that kind of family history is having family support. Because, you know, when you have the support of the people who are closest to you and they're in your life and they're really part of your team working on these things, I mean, as you know, Stephanie, what a huge difference that can make in a person's recovery.
Right. And let's say someone, either their family's passed away or they don't have a lot of contacts because maybe OCD, they've isolated themselves. What's a good way for people to build up that support system or get to know that there's people out there that are willing to support them? What's a good way to go about doing that? Or,
well, I usually start with, you know, hopefully with some low hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people that are still interested in being around the person, but you know, maybe the person has been ignoring their calls or hasn't gotten in touch with them in a long time, but the door most likely is still open. So that's a good place to start. But besides that, I mean, there are a lot of support groups that can be helpful too. Just, you know, finding other people who are dealing with the same thing and you know, meeting people that way, and at least having regular support that, depending on kind of how the group is set up, may extend outside of the group sessions.
So your Facebook group would be one of those ways to get support, right? I mean, it's not treatment, as you say on the page, but it does, yes, provide other people that you're in the same kind of, it's that, what's that concept in group therapy? Universality.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Just seeing, I think one of the important things about numbers in the group is that as the number grows, it just underscores that it's not this abstract idea of you're not alone. Look, here are, you know, this many people just in this, you know, this one group that's just kind of growing, you know, organically, that's of people who have very similar things to what you're experiencing.
Oh, and I think you gained 2 members since I looked it up this morning. You're at 104.
Ah, so, okay, good, yeah. Good, yes.
So that's pretty amazing. So,
well, you know, it seems to be, I don't know how Facebook does its algorithms, but it seems like as we've grown, we've been growing more quickly.
And I'm just going to go over some other examples of malevolent OCD just to kind of reiterate for everyone. So it's feeling like you might stab someone, feeling like you might be a pedophile, feeling like you're going to push somebody in front of a train, thinking that you're going to sexually assault someone, you're going to become a mass shooter, or being a psychopath. And I know from your article in Psychology Today, you had a good point that if you're thinking that you might be these things, probably a pretty good chance that you're not going to be these things.
That's right. Almost certainly. Again, you know, keep that little bit of you know, non-zero chance that OCD is right. But really, you know, we're not worried about it.
And in closing, what's some advice or what's the kind of a pearl of wisdom you would give for people that are starting to kind of confront the malevolent OCD and maybe aren't really sure where to turn to get help? What would you suggest for them?
You know, I often recommend that people check out a great resource online, the International OCD Foundation, www.iocdf.org. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's a great place to get information, to find links to support groups, to therapists who provide the right kind of treatment. So I would say start there.
Great. And your website, sethgillihan.com, and I'll spell that for everyone again. It's sethgillihan.com. And your books are Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Made Simple and Retrain Your Brain, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy in 7 Weeks, and Overcoming OCD, A Journey to Recovery. And thank you so much for talking about malevolent OCD today.
Yes, my pleasure. I'll just mention the final book, the OCD one, is with the first author, Janet Singer, who tells the story of her son's recovery. It's really a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for having me on, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Well, this has been another episode of Talking Brains. Thank you for listening. And again, Dr. Gillihan's site is sethgillihan.com. That's sethgillihan.com. And I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Sarkis, and my website is stephaniesarkis.com. Thank you.